My name is Juliana Reno. With me up here on this fabulous podium dais are my partners, Tora Johnson, Lisa Tavares, and Harry Atlas. And we are going to be talking today about wellness, fiduciary wellness, financial wellness, and what we call regular old health wellness. There are a bunch of people joining us via webinar. So the first announcement is for those of you in the room, there are little cards on your table. That's how we're going to do the questions so that we don't have to pass the mic around. So if you have a question in the room, write it on a card, hold it up. Shiny here will come around and get it, and then she'll pass them up to us. If you are with us via webinar, you'll see there's a portion of your screen where you can ask a question, and those will get transcribed and given to us also. We're going to save, because we've got people in the room and people on the webinar to level things out, we're just going to save all the questions for the end, unless it's really urgent, in which case you can, you know, jump up and down and wave your hands and whatever, and we'll figure something out.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point. Wait. So we're going to start. The first part is going to be on the retirement plan side, and the second part is going to be on the health plan side. And what do I have any other announcements? We're planning on taking a 45, maybe 50 minutes, and then leaving 10 minutes at the end for questions, just in terms of your planning. Okay, and there's more food in the back. Sorry, for those of you on the webinar, you don't get the food. And with that, I'll just pass it over to Lisa and Harry.
Good afternoon. We're going to start with the fiduciary wellness piece, and we're going to start by talking about an overview of fiduciary. We're not going to go into detail with respect to fiduciary duties today, but we wanted to go over very generally what those duties are, as well bring up the concept of fiduciary duties throughout our presentation. The general fiduciary duties are the duty of loyalty, and that's to act solely in the interest of plan participants and beneficiaries. You may have heard of the exclusive purpose rule for providing benefits, and that's what that particular duty is about, and we'll talk about that more later. The duty to monitor, all plan fiduciaries have responsibility to continually monitor service providers, and that also includes the duty to ensure that only reasonable plan expenses are used with respect to plan assets. Next is the duty to follow plan terms and the day-to-day operation of the plan. Next is the duty of prudence and care. And lastly is the duty to diversify plan investments.
I didn't turn on very hot mic. That's what it is. The next slide here is regarding the duty of prudence. I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail here, but this gives you more detail about what will be our focus today, which is primarily the duty of prudence. And we wanted to take this opportunity for this webinar to talk about the new DOL fiduciary rule. You may have seen even in the general news about this fiduciary rule, which has caused quite a stir in the investment and insurance industry. The rule has been underway for a number of years, and the best way to generally think about it from the plan sponsor perspective is that it establishes a best interest standard. So that's kind of an overlay of the various fiduciary rules that I laid out and requirements. And the DOL rule is essentially a combination of the duty of prudence and the duty of loyalty. It applies to 403B plans as well as 401K plans and other retirement plans. The new rule expands and clarifies who is a fiduciary. And from the plan sponsor perspective, you can think of it as a trigger to determine who is a fiduciary based upon whether they're making a recommendation that could reasonably be viewed as a suggestion. So it's something that may be a suggestion to take a specific action or to refrain from taking a course of action. In order to be a fiduciary, you must also receive direct or indirect compensation. The fiduciary must also acknowledge in writing that they are a fiduciary. And in terms of complying with the DOL rule, the question is whether the recommended investment advice is provided for a fee or for a compensation. So there are recommendations that advisors may be making with respect to buying, selling, or holding securities, how to invest securities, and probably most applicable to the everyday operations of plans, recommendations about how to handle rollovers, generally the advice that participants are getting when they call the 1-800 line or look at information online about the opportunity to take a distribution and the rules regarding rollovers. That's probably the greatest impact with respect to plan sponsors and what you need to understand going forward. The DOL's goal overall is to shed light on what they refer to as conflicted advice. On the DOL website, they've actually done a good job of giving general fact sheets and information about what's 900 or so pages of regulations. The regulations are in a couple different sets, but it's essentially 900. When I gave it to my LA, she's like, my assistant, she's like, are you really wanting me to print all of this? I was like, yes, I'm going to read it. I read all of this paper. So we're trying to today just talk about at a high level what plan sponsors need to know. The rule primarily impacts service providers, and there will be changes that you'll see in the upcoming year from your service providers. When you think about conflicted advice, we have to remember the general fiduciary rules are to protect plan participants and beneficiaries. The fiduciary rule extends what was already in ERISA and extends what a few years ago you heard about with respect to the disclosures under the ERISA 408B2 rules, and you've started to get presumably disclosures from service providers, and then there's a separate set of disclosures that a plan provides to participants. This new rule is sort of the last leg of the fiduciary guidance that the Department of Labor wanted to get out. The new rule goes into effect generally in April 2010. And from the plan sponsor's perspective, one of the things that you need to be concerned about is the difference between investment education versus investment advice. If you recall a few minutes ago, I talked about a fiduciary having a responsibility with respect to investment advice. Investment education within parameters can still be provided. Education would include the asset allocation models that we see the various service providers put together if they use the designated investment alternatives. Those are essentially the plan investment options that you've selected, and they provide disclosure with respect to rates of return and fees. Those asset allocation models are still education. They're general materials that can be provided to participants that are education, but where the world is different is with respect to investment advice. The Department of Labor understood that there are a number of things that our retirement plan record keepers and third-party administrators do for plan sponsors, including providing investment platforms, but those platforms have to be provided in the best interest of the plan and the participants, and the fiduciary or provider that's providing that information must disclose any of their inherent conflicts of interest. And that would be the fees that they're getting with respect to the investment options that are on whatever record keeper's platform. Another area in which investment advice is exempted is the investment selection and monitoring assistance. That's most commonly going to come up in the RFP context, and if you go to RFP and you're going to a new provider, you don't necessarily know what investments are on your platform. Most RFPs may include an example of various investments from that particular provider. A lot of them are going to be their proprietary funds. That type of information in the context of RFP is not investment advice, as well as general communications and newsletters. There's a little delay. I'm trying to advance the slide. Oh, okay. I guess it's a delay. There are two separate rules for plans based upon size. The first is for plans of less than $50 million in plan assets. In that case, the DOL understood that those smaller plan sponsors are heavily relying upon the various service providers. So there's an exemption that's in place as long as a contract is entered into between the fiduciary and the plan sponsor. It's called the best interest contract exemption. And under that exemption, sponsors are to receive information about the types of compensation that a fiduciary receives, including 12B1 fees, commissions, and revenue sharing. The contract has to have an acknowledgement by the fiduciary of their status. It must also set forth language in which the fiduciary commits to basic standards of impartial conduct. The fiduciary must disclose any of the conflicts they have, and the fiduciary must adopt policies and procedures to minimize conflicts. That rule still lives in the world in which the other ERISA rules have been, including 480B2. So while that compensation is being disclosed under this best interest exemption, it still has to be reasonable, and the plan sponsor still has a responsibility to ensure that those fees that are being disclosed are reasonable. This special best interest exception has an extended effective date to 1/1/18, so it won't be until later next year in which you start to see these contracts that we're talking about for smaller plans. There's a different rule for larger plans because the Department of Labor assumes the plans that are $50 million and larger have investment advisors that the plans have hired. They have robust investment committees.
Lisa, for the small plans, do you think that these best interest contracts are going to be built in to the service provider agreements, or do you think they're going to be separate agreements?
Well, I think it depends on whether the providers want to open up their service agreement to negotiation. So I think there's some service providers that may want to do separate contracts so that they can not have to renegotiate some of the general terms, and maybe when there's a renewal. That's sort of what we have seen in the 480B2 context, even though there's supposed to be new contracts. Sort of been when there's a renewal, then the contracts are opened up. I mentioned before that distributions are sort of the big impact for plan sponsors, and that's something to look out for. You will start to see a difference in the way third-party administrators are providing information to your participants in the near future in order to comply with the rules. So I'm trying to forward the slides to turn over to Harry to talk about fiduciary litigation. I think it's coming here, but you can go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa. So Lisa's given an excellent overview of the legal background. I want to talk, shift gears a little bit and talk about a phenomenon that we're really seeing. It's not a new phenomenon, but it's really, I think, exploded in the last 6 months to a year, and that's these lawsuits that are being brought against plan sponsors. And there's a few different types of these lawsuits. There's 401k litigation, which is certainly not new, although I think it probably went into somewhat of – it's become more in the vogue in the last year or so. There was a high-profile Supreme Court case about a year ago which affirmed a duty to monitor plans, and that seems to have created an interest in these types of lawsuits. Within the last 2 months, we've seen a flood of lawsuits relating to 403B plans. Those are plans sponsored by tax-exempt organizations that are very similar in function to 401k plans, but have some unique attributes that we'll talk about. And there's been some very high-profile, some of the largest 403B plans in the country have been sued for these sort of allegations of breach of fiduciary duty. And then the third type of litigation that we're seeing, also not new, but there's been a lot of it recently, are against financial institutions that have their own products in the plan. And that presents a separate type of conflict of self, potential allegations of self-dealing. So what we've seen, and we'll talk, I'll talk about it, mention a few of the big settlements. There's the 401k litigation has been going on for longer, so some of these cases have worked their way through the system. And there's been some very, very high-profile and large settlements. What ends up happening is there are usually some sort of corrective contributions to the plan to make participants whole for losses, and those are losses resulting from allegations of excessive fees and poor investment performance. There's the class representatives in these cases have received a fairly nominal sum of money for participating as representatives, and the plaintiff's attorneys have done extremely well. They're keeping a big cut of it, and I say that because what seems to be happening is there's a big financial incentive for plaintiff's attorneys to bring these cases, and what it seems like is that if they can get past a motion to dismiss, which is a preliminary motion, then it becomes a factual question as to whether the plan did or did not breach its fiduciary duties, which gets very expensive and difficult, arduous to prove all of that. And that's where these settlements are coming up. So just to mention a few of them. Yeah, so Boeing was a pretty high-profile one, $57 million settlement. Litigation had been going on for 9 years, almost 10 years, and a host of allegations of excessive fees, allegations that the plan sponsor used or was influenced to use a particular record keeper because of its corporate banking relationship, which is something that many people do, so that's pretty common. Imprudent offering of a specific type of sector fund, imprudent management of a company stock fund, Lockheed Martin was another one, $62 million settlement, payment, you know, allegations of excessive fees, allegations that the stable value or the cash option was not properly managed, and that's a claim which is coming up in a lot of these cases. There's allegations being made regarding the stable value or preservation fund. After the financial crisis, a lot of plans had problems with their stable value funds and switched to money market funds and have had money market funds which have earned basically nothing for the last 8 years. The claims are being brought about the decision to offer a money market fund. And then allegations around company stock funds. For those of you that have company stock in the plan, that's a particularly fertile area, although there has been a Supreme Court decision which has made those cases a little bit hard to actually prevail. And Novant Health. I wanted to mention one ruling that came out, I think, last month, which was actually a good ruling. So there are some positive signs. Chevron was sued over its 401k plan, and with the typical host of allegations of excessive fees and poor performance, and the court in that, at least at this preliminary phase, found that just making these sort of allegations that one can glean from a typical Form 5500 annual report, you can look at an annual report and see what's offered and how much is being paid. It's simply having that sort of data is insufficient to draw a conclusion that there's likely a breach of fiduciary duty. So that case was sent back to the plaintiffs to replead it, and I guess if they can't, it may be dismissed ultimately. Some courts have come to that conclusion, but a lot of courts, including the Fourth Circuit Court and the BB&T case in our circuit, where we are in Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, has come to an opposite conclusion. and has refused to dismiss these sort of cases that are made on these allegations. Basically, they're making allegations. If you have fees at this level, it must be that you didn't have a prudent process. And so a lot of courts are accepting that. To mention the 403B litigation is really, there's some unique attributes to 403B plans. 403B plans, for those of you who have them, are probably aware, there's a lot of very old funding vehicles, contracts from different insurance companies, notably a lot of TXF plans, a lot of TXF funding vehicles. And some 403B plans have historically had multiple vendors and have offered basically all the funds that the vendor allows. So you'll have 403B plans that have several hundred investment choices. Some plans have curtailed that, but there's some big ones out there that haven't or that have only curtailed it recently. And those types of plans are being sued. If you have a 403B plan, and I work with numerous plan sponsors that do, I think one thing to keep an eye on here is that there's a lot of 403B plans out there that have old contracts that at one point in time the sponsor was told, you don't have any control over that contract. You don't have any control over it. So sponsors have said, well, if we don't have any control over it, there's no point in us paying any more attention to it. It's just old legacy stuff. Now, I've heard in the marketplace that the fund sponsors are starting to revisit those restrictions and maybe loosen them. If that happens, that puts an onus on plan sponsors to be aware that they maybe now do have some control over those old assets and to be mindful that they may need to take a second look at those. So I think that's something for 403B sponsors to keep in mind. And with that, I will turn it back to Lisa to talk about fiduciary best practices.
Thank you, Harry. Your last point dovetails nicely with what we want to start with on fiduciary best practices with respect to plan oversight. We generally always recommend that our plan sponsors have a committee that's delegated by the board, and that committee becomes the plan administrator and is responsible for oversight over plan investments and fees. We get a lot of questions about, well, aren't we too small to have a committee? And I think generally say no.
Right.
even in small organizations.
We have a two-person committee.
Right, because what the cases go to is the deliberative process, the documentation, and in the absence of having a committee, it's very difficult to defend yourself if you don't have some process that's been put in place. So we encourage people to do that. The committee is useful because it helps identify the employees that are actually acting as the fiduciaries. It allows those people to be trained and to ensure that they have the type of expertise or have the ability to get expertise by outside experts if they need it in order to administer the plan. And the board should retain a reporting mechanism for the committee to report back to them about how things have been handled. Turn off over to Harry to talk about fiduciary investment advisors.
And I'll keep the next few slides brief because I know we have some time constraints, but just a couple of things for committees to be mindful of. If you have somebody coming to your meeting presenting investment information, understand what their status is. ERISA recognizes a non-discretionary investment advisor under 321 of ERISA. That's a fiduciary position that has to be documented and acknowledged. There's a so-called 338, which is like a discretionary advisor. But there's many plans that have that really have somebody coming to the committee who says that they're an investment consultant, and they hold themselves out as not being a fiduciary. That's going to get hard to do going forward, and it's something to be mindful of. An investment policy statement is a roadmap for the committee to follow in its deliberations, and something that every committee should have. And the last thing that I'd say is that every committee should make sure that their organization has fiduciary insurance. From what I understand, it's still not that expensive to get, and it's very particularly important in the environment of all these lawsuits being brought to have coverage, including defense coverage.
And next, we want
to, before you jump in, I just want to drive one point home, which is that if you don't, and it's something Harry just talked about, which is personal liability for breaches of fiduciary duty. So if you don't have a committee, then your board members are personally liable. They really don't like that. They really, when there's a problem and you say, oh, by the way, you've been named in this lawsuit, they get very upset about that. So one of the, aside from all of these procedural smart reasons to have it, for the sake of happiness in the company, it's a great idea to have a committee, and then you protect that committee with insurance.
For the sake of your job, and it's really simple. It doesn't need to be elaborate. We can easily help you put together a committee and walk you through that process, which we do all the time. I want to talk briefly about privacy and cybersecurity. This is a new area which is evolving from a fiduciary perspective. You've all probably heard of PHI in the HIPAA context, but there are almost every state has a law with respect to PII, which is personally identifiable information. And when you think about it as plan sponsors, if you're using any of the HRS systems or whatever mechanisms are going back and forth, we're transmitting tremendous amounts of information, people's personal information, their addresses, social security numbers, et cetera, every day without the protections of HIPAA. So the Department of Labor and the ERISA itself doesn't have any specific rules about cybersecurity or privacy at this point, but they've started to talk about it publicly, and the duty of loyalty and the duty of care seem to apply. Trying to advance one more slide. Plan sponsors should start to protect themselves and to protect participants' assets and information. The ERISA Advisory Council, which is an organization that holds hearings and seeks information to direct the Department of Labor to create guidance for plan sponsors, has talked about the cybersecurity issue over the last couple of years. They just held additional hearings in the last 2 months, which one of our clients testified at. So you can expect to see more on this issue. What we need plan sponsors to consider is to create a process with their plan providers, and to try to contract protections for themselves, which is not that easy because we've been doing it, and it's not easy to get these service providers to agree to terms that are favorable or to at least allocate liability. But we have had plans who had theft, most commonly being a plan participant has a disgruntled family member who figured out their password and gets in. Well, there's no FDIC, PBGC, special insurance, or anything. The money's gone, the money's gone. So with the risk of a cybersecurity attack or something that's massive, that's even more significant, and there's no insurance to protect most of our clients at the size of their plans from that type of occurrence. There is, as our understanding, some type of cybersecurity insurance people can get, but you should also be talking to your brokers about additional coverage under fiduciary liability policies. But we would encourage you to work with us to help identify some of these issues in the future. Do we want to skip over the takeaways?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I'll be fine.
Yeah, so just to summarize, Lisa and I are going to wanted to go through a list of bottom line takeaways from today. Takeaway number one, this is probably the most important, make sure you have fiduciary liability insurance. Even if you can have the best process, fiduciary process in the world, if you have to prove it in court, that's going to be expensive. Number two, understand your plan's fee structure. They can be very complicated. Understand money flows. Understand how everybody is getting paid and through what mechanism. Number three, keep abreast of the competitive market landscape. When you negotiated a particular deal 4 years ago when your plan was a specific size, the plan may be much bigger. The marketplace may be more competitive. You may be overpaying now even though you weren't before. And finally, negotiate with your record keepers. Negotiate if there is excessive record revenue sharing. Negotiate an ERISA fee budget where some of that money can be rebated to the plan. Or alternatively, look at a so-called fee leveling arrangement where all of the revenue sharing is rebated to participants and then the fees are paid on a more transparent and equivalent basis.
Also, we've talked about having an orderly process. That's to evaluate investment fund performance, and that's the documenting process, review and documenting process we've been referring to. Plan sponsors should be careful to avoid unnecessary duplication of investment funds. You should be deliberate with respect to cash equivalent options. Harry talked about stable value and money markets and sort of how things sit. We need to actively review and manage those. And then lastly, to negotiate protection for cybersecurity threats or theft. Quickly, we want to mention that DOL and IRS audits appear to be on the rise. I think we have a record number of audits of our clients going on. The Department of Labor hired 2,000 investigators a couple of years ago. They've apparently all been trained. The undersecretary of that part of the Department of Labor has said that they intend to touch, I think her words are, every retirement plan in the country in 5 years. So there are different levels of audits we're seeing. Some are more depth audits, but you should be thinking about the fiduciary issues because we have in these audits seen fiduciary questions. We've been requested to provide service provider disclosures, committee minutes, things like that. And next, I'm going to talk about financial wellness. You'll notice we didn't put this in fiduciary wellness because we purposely would not want fiduciaries to be acting in terms of providing financial wellness. I had talked earlier a little bit about the difference between investment education and investment advice. We know employers are trying to help their employees manage for lifetime, whether it's retirement, college savings, et cetera, to understand better savings and investment so you have a happier workplace and people can manage their stress. There are a lot of different products that are out there. And frankly, we don't have a lot of involvement in what those products are, but I think there's still some legal issues that need to be looked at, and it's not as innocent as it may appear, I think, when people are providing different options that you can promote to your employees. Specifically, I think there are tax consequences. So we wanted to mention the general tax rule. If you're giving an employee something, unless it falls under an exclusion as a de minimis fringe, there's generally going to be a tax consequence, meaning you need to report it on the W-2. So if there are different services that you may be providing, whether it's advice, there are companies where you can sign up your employee and they can put in all their personal financial information. The information from your 401k or 403b record keeper can be sent there, and it all gets combined and it helps them plan for the future. Well, if that service is being provided for free, if it's not de minimis, it could have a tax effect that you need to consider fair market value, things like that. So don't hesitate to reach out to us about just making sure your tax reporting house is in order. And now we're going to move to medical wellness programs.
Hi, everybody.
Thank you, Lisa.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. No, you did jump in because you're going to do most of the talking. But by way of reintroduction and transition, this is Tora Johnson. She's going to talk about the medical wellness programs. I wanted to, just taking off something Lisa said, though, add that when you're talking about wellness programs, you need to think about tax issues. We didn't go into a lot of detail in that in the slide, but a lot of our clients say things like, Oh, yeah. We give our employees vouchers to the gym, right? Good. Those are taxable. A lot of people don't know that. They give them – the people give their employees a lot of great things, and they assume – because they're good people. Like, if I do something good for my employees, then that will be okay because I'm being a good employer. And it will be okay, but you have to declare it as taxable most of the time. So the wellness programs that we're talking about here generally are not taxable because they're part of a health program. But that's not always true. So you need to be careful, especially if you have a separate program that you're now calling a wellness program, like giving out Fitbits or these vouchers or – low-fat meals, or all of these little tiny add-ons, Weight Watchers, free Weight Watchers, yeah, lots of these little add-ons that can get really, really complicated. So that's just a little
pre-bridge to over to Torah.
Which is great, because I'm not touching on tax, because I didn't think I would have time to get to tax or ERISA. So what I plan to talk about is the fact that it's not just HIPAA's non-discrimination rules anymore when you're talking about medical wellness programs. We now have the EEOC very much in the mix. They issued final regulations in May under both the ADA and GINA, so the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And the EEOC has been quite active in litigation. They have filed 3 suits against large employers because of their wellness programs. I put those a little bit to the side. I'm not going to go into any detail because they're in various – one of them has been dismissed, one's on appeal by the EEOC, and the other, the EEOC just as of last week got a ruling against them. But those cases are important to note because Congress has taken attention to – where the EEOC is going with wellness programs and actually issued or there's pending legislation called Preserving Employee Wellness Program Act, where Congress would like to go back to, or certain members would like to go back to the pre-EEOC involvement and say, if you comply with HIPAA's non-discrimination rules, good to go.
Great. So I'm just going to add a little bit there, cause mm-hmm. it's just because it's a little fun, which is that when the proposed rules came out under the ADA and GINA, the employer community wrote in a lot of comments and said, this is inconsistent with HIPAA. We can't comply with both. And the response was, that's not true. You can comply with both, but, yeah, the new ones are harder, right? So you can. You just have to follow the harder ones. So nobody liked that answer. Because we all had, you know, adjusted for HIPAA already, and we didn't want to adjust again, and there were a lot of complaints, and the EEOC just didn't care. I mean, they did care, but they believe it's their mandate and their job. I don't want to suggest that they're doing this out of ill will, but Congress is listening and is thinking about trying to pull it back. I don't know whether that's going to work or not.
Am I going on the way? So I don't know where I'm pointing. We'll go. Okay, good. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time just bringing everybody up to speed with HIPAA's non-discrimination rules. And first off, I mean, the basic rule under HIPAA is that a group health plan cannot discriminate with regard to eligibility, premiums, contributions based on health factors. Health factors include your medical condition or your claims records. And so to have a wellness program under HIPAA, you need an exception because most of the wellness programs that are tied to a health plan or separately a health plan in and of themselves want to give you a reduction in your premium or in your copay for based on a health status. So we need this exception. And the exceptions divide wellness programs into 2 flavors, participatory or health contingent. The participatory wellness programs don't condition a reward or ability on the ability to meet a health standard. And they're available to everyone. And there's no limit on the size of the reward that's being offered. Although put a pin on that because we're going to come back to that when we talk about the ADA and the new final regulations. So an example here is you reward your employees for filling out a health risk assessment. It doesn't matter what they say on it, but the mere fact that they have filled it out is participatory, and they get a discount.
So I will think that works.
Oh, good.
Okay. Should have practiced.
The health contingent is when there's a reward based on satisfying a standard related to a health factor. And there are a few rules that you need to meet in order to have it pass muster under the non-discrimination rules. First off, everybody has to have an opportunity to participate at least once a year. Here, there is a cap on the reward, and it's 30% of the total cost of coverage, which is the employee and the employer portion of the premium. You can actually bump that up to 50% if it's related to nicotine. And for employees, if only employees are eligible for it, then that 30/50% is based off of the premium for individual-only coverage. If you have dependents who are also eligible, then it's based off of that dependent coverage premium. It has to be reasonably designed to promote health or prevent disease, and you have to have reasonable alternative standards that are available. So if it's a health contingent that is not based on outcomes, but just on activity, then you need to be able to offer an alternative to an individual for whom it's unreasonably difficult because of a medical condition to satisfy the standard. If it's outcome-based, then you need to have it available to all, everyone, anyone who can't meet the standard. So that would be an example is you have to have a BMI of under 25. And if you don't have a BMI under 25, then you need to automatically be given an alternative, even if you don't meet this unreasonably difficult because of a medical condition. And then you need to notify folks that they have an ability to ask for a reasonable alternative standard. So there's a notice requirement under HIPAA, as we know and love it today, and then we're going to discuss a new notice requirement under the ADA rules. So the ADA generally prohibits employers from discriminating against individuals on the basis of disability with regard to compensation and terms and conditions of employment. And the general rule, although there are a bunch of exceptions, is that you can't ask an employee a disability-related question or require a medical exam. The important exception here is for wellness programs.
Yeah, let me just say there's other obvious exceptions, right? So you can do medical exams if they're required by law. So, for example, truck drivers can be given drug tests, things like that. You can obviously ask someone who's asking for an ADA accommodation for their disability, obviously can ask things. So there's a lot of exceptions. We're just working on the voluntary wellness program one here today.
Yeah. And now we're into these new final regulations, and they say that to be a voluntary wellness program, you have to have a reasonable chance of improving health and preventing disease, can't be overly burdensome, can't be a ploy for violating the ADA, can't be suspect in the method chosen. These are relatively common sense. What is not necessarily is they have said to meet the requirement to have a reasonable chance of improving health or preventing disease, if your wellness program takes the form of an HRA, then you need to report back to the individuals. HRA, health risk assessment, you need to report back to your employees the results so that they can improve, or you have to take the results and use them to design a program going forward. You can't just collect the information and sit on it. You also, to be voluntary, you can't require employees to participate. You can't deny coverage under your health plan for folks not participating in your wellness program. And that was part of the EEOC litigation that we saw earlier. So it's very important. You can't say, as a condition to be in our health plan, our major medical plan, you must be in our wellness program. You can't limit benefits for those who are not participating, and you can't take any adverse employment action against non-participating employees. So now it gets to be a little bit more fun. There's a new notice requirement. So under HIPAA, you have to notify folks of the reasonable alternative standards. Under the ADA, you need to tell participants what medical information will be collected, how it will be used, who it's going to be disclosed to, the restrictions on disclosure, and how it's going to be protected. And that is what's important is that we're now in open enrollment season. So anyone with a wellness program that's asking disability-related questions or has biometric reading should be including this notice in open enrollment materials so that you have this covered.
Right. We're seeing – we have a lot of employers who around this time of year are doing wellness fairs and doing biometric screenings, right? And they're voluntary. They're voluntary. You got to give them a notice. That's what this ADA rule is about. A medical exam, if you are having a biometric screening, that's a medical exam. Let's just be clear about that. Okay? And the ADA says you need a notice.
And if you have an HRA that's going to get to a disability-related question, then you need the notice. And the ADA has their own rules on incentives. So when Juliana said, it's enough, we've got HIPAA, was the outcry, and it's inconsistent, it's really getting to this incentive issue because it's a different cap on incentives if you have a disability-related question or a medical exam that's required as part of the wellness program. And here, under the ADA, the most you can reward an employee is 30% of the total cost of single coverage. So if you remember what I had said earlier, if you had dependents involved, you could go up to you could use the premium rate for the family coverage. Here, it's just based off of the single coverage rate. And I wanted to make a little footnote on smoking cessation program. So this one's interesting in that under HIPAA, you can go up to 50%. Here, we have a cap at 30%. If it's subject to the ADA. So if you're just asking employees, have you used tobacco, are you nicotine-free, that's not going to be subject to the ADA because EEOC has said that that is not a medical inquiry and it's not disability-related. So then you're not subject to the 30% cap under the ADA. But if there's a screening, if you're testing to see if they've used nicotine, then you're subject to the ADA and you've got to keep the cap at the 30%. There are confidentiality provisions under the ADA. They apply here to the results of the wellness program. The general rule is that you should only be providing aggregate results that are not reasonably likely to disclose the identity of the individual back to the employer. The exception would be if the wellness program is part of your major medical program that's already HIPAA compliant and you've done the plan amendments and you have your policies and procedures, then you can disclose identifiable information back to the plan to administer the plan. Switching gears to Gina, and the general rule here is that employers may not request, require, or purchase genetic information about their employees. Here, too, there's the exception for voluntary wellness programs. The definition of what is a wellness program is very similar to what we just talked about under the ADA, so I'm not going to repeat myself, although I want to point out that there's a new requirement under GINA to get authorizations. In particular, if you have a spouse who is being incentivized to answer questions about their current health status, there's an authorization requirement that we will discuss. So that authorization must be prior, knowing, voluntary, and written. Although if you are doing electronic wellness programs, you can do it electronically. The authorization can be done electronically. The authorization has to be understandable, and it's got to tell folks what type of genetic information are you requesting, the purposes of obtaining it, and restrictions on the disclosure of genetic information. So let's talk about when you have to get it. So this is when it gets a little bit complicated under GINA. If an employee is completing HRA questions regarding the employee's own genetic information, then regardless of any reward that may be offered, any incentive, the employee has to sign that authorization. But the question then is, what is genetic information? So genetic information also includes family medical history. So if you're asking an employee, do you have history of heart disease in your family, you need to get their authorization prior to requesting that information. Now, what the rules do that came out in May says that they allow you to ask a spouse about the spouse's current manifestation of a disease or disorder. In general, you can ask a spouse to complete an HRA and state whether or not, we'll talk about their current and past health status. But that's considered genetic information of the employee because they're part of the same family. Even though there's no blood ties, it's considered the employee's genetic information. Therefore, you need authorization, but you don't go to the employee, you go to the spouse. So you get the employee's authorization when you're asking about the employee's family history. You get the spouse's authorization when you're asking about the spouse's current health status.
It's really weird and confusing, and just keep the slides. Or call us. We have a chart, and we have to look at the chart every time.
So now let's talk about rewards, because you can have rewards under Gina. They have a 30% limit as well, based off of cost of self-only coverage. But you're allowed to give 30% to the employee and attribute an additional 30% to the spouse who is participating in the wellness program. This is why the caps are incredibly difficult and why you see potential legislation to say, let's just go back to HIPAA's non-discrimination rules. So let's we got to talk about employee versus spouse. So for an employee, you may offer a reward for the HRA that includes questions about genetic information, including family history, but you need to make very clear that the employee gets the reward whether or not they answer the question about their genetic information, so their family history. You can have the question, but they get the reward even if they skip the family history. On the spouse, you can actually make the reward contingent upon the spouse discussing their current health status or their past history, the spouse's own health, not their family history, but the spouse's own health. And then what do you do with the genetic information that you collect? Well, you can share it with the individual, you can share it with healthcare professionals, and then if it's part of a group health plan subject to HIPAA's privacy rules, you can use it for plan administration. And so that brings me to the last slide as to what to do with all of this. So it's time to review your wellness programs to the extent that you have one. Make sure that your rewards are consistent with the caps under HIPAA, GINA, and the ADA. For the ADA, make sure you have a notice in place for January 2017 if you're asking disability-related questions or have a medical component to it. And obtain GINA authorizations. I mean, we haven't seen HRAs that have asked family history for a very long time, so I don't see a lot of clients who need to get employee authorization. But if you're incentivizing spouses to talk about their own current health status or their past health status, you need to build in a GINA authorization. And then who knows where Congress will go with potential legislation which might roll back the EEOC regulations.
Okay. So that concludes the formal part of the presentation. We've got a bunch of questions. We've got another, where did we start? We
can't get to 1:15.
So we've got officially another 5 minutes. I think we're going to keep going a little bit past that. And you can feel free to wander out, but we won't go too far past. So we'll each try to at least get one or two questions in. So the questions have come up. If you have more in the room, you can feed them through Shiny. Otherwise, Harry, why don't you start?
Okay. This question is talk more about why using your bank as your 401k or 403b provider might or might not be a good idea. I certainly don't think there's anything inherently wrong with using your organization's bank as the record keeper. There's certainly nothing inherently wrong. I think where you could get into trouble is if you're paying an above market rate for services and at the same time, the bank is, you know, you're asking the bank for example, an extension of your credit line or some sort of accommodation. In the meantime, you're paying an above-market rate for your 401k plan. somebody takes a step back and looks at the two things together and says, wait a second, you're using the 401k plan or the 403b plan to benefit your corporate existence.
And you won't really know that unless you benchmark.
Right. That's why you have to do some sort of external look and not just stay with the bank forever.
There's another question about addressing the difference between a 321 fiduciary and a 338 fiduciary, and talking about what the independent fiduciary does for the plan sponsor with company stock. The 321 fiduciary is what we see most commonly. They're non-discretionary, so they're the advisor that reviews the investment options, provides the quarterly review of investment options. They monitoring performance. They may suggest that you change a manager or the types of fund classes that are being used. They help negotiate with record keepers, and they can help do the benchmarking of the plan expenses. And they have a good sense of the market generally versus the 338 investment manager, which is discretionary, and that's the person or company that actually is making decisions about investment options and has the authority and ability to direct actions. They have complete control of the fund lineup. Presumably, they would still be working with the plan committee or plan fiduciaries, but they have discretion. And it's more expensive, obviously, to have a 338. So what we see most commonly is a 321. With respect to independent fiduciaries, they come up in not just the context of company stock, but an independent fiduciary could be put in place to be to ensure that there's no conflict between the plan sponsor, plan fiduciary with respect to issues. And in the case of company stock, you would have someone independent who can evaluate whether that company stock is an appropriate investment for the retirement plan. Is it in the best interest of participants? Is it a good stock? What's the horizon, the thoughts on where that stock will be in the future? And then there's no confusion with respect to whether or not the company wanted to advance its own interests by putting stock in the plan. One, the lawsuits always talk about employees feeling like they were forced or that there was little choice with respect to stock that's put in the plan. An independent fiduciary could help build the defense against that selection of company stock as an investment option.
And just to add one thing about the independent fiduciary for company stock, it certainly has value as far as putting a barrier between the company and the decision to have the stock, but it's not a 100% shield, because a lot of the company stock litigation is around inside information and information that wasn't disclosed to and reflected in the share price. And then you get into is the independent fiduciary is probably not going to have the information disclosed to them either. So it definitely has value, but it's not an absolute shield.
Are all the questions on our side?
We've got a few over here. So how should we send the ADA notice to employees? And so part of open enrollment, and then make sure to put it in your new hire packet as well. You need it in both places. And then can you put the GINA authorization in the open enrollment in the new hire? And I guess my concern there would be that you're supposed to give it to them before you're collecting the information, but I'm afraid that might be too early, too far away from when you're actually collecting the genetic information. So I'd prefer it to be tucked in closer to when you're collecting the genetic information.
Okay, so the next question is, what kind of return on investment ROI are you seeing in wellness plans? And what I'm seeing is a lot of smoke. They will tell you that the return on investment is any number of things. I would suggest that you ask a lot of hard questions about that if you are counting on the returns, if you're counting on the ROI. mostly I tell my clients, just don't count on the ROI and then you won't worry about it too much. Because frankly, one of the values of a wellness plan is keeping the already healthy people healthy, right? It's also to take the people who are the sickest and have the most health expenses and raise them up a little bit in terms of health. But if you stop rewarding the very healthy people, you know, they may not continue to behave that well. So I try hard not to count on ROI. I think, by and large, that the insurance companies that service TPAs don't have great data on that because people change. Even though they stay, even if they stay your employees for 10 years, which is a big if, the odds are good that you're going to have more than one insurance company over that period of time. So the ROI doesn't usually pay off right away. The programs where the ROI pays off right away are highly invasive programs, which are very effective and really make employees angry. Sometimes they're very grateful, but sometimes they're like, wait a minute, why is this nurse calling me and telling me I have to go to the doctor because I have COPD? So it's all a trade-off, and a lot of it has to do with employee satisfaction. I think we'll do one more round and then call it a day.
Sure. The question is, explain the litigation issue with offering money market and or stable value. Was it negative performance, and why can't you offer multiple options? So the litigation issue, I think it's a classic hindsight 2020 issue. I think when coming up on the financial crisis, a lot of plans had stable value. There were problems with stable value. There was concern that the insurance wrappers that keep those products at stable value were going to fail. And some stable value providers got out of the market for fear that that it was going to be a losing proposition. So a lot of retraction in that environment. People went to money market funds, a lot of treasury money market funds, because that was guaranteed by the U.S. and very safe and sound. Now 7 or 8 years have passed, and there was no cataclysmic blow-up of stable value funds, and government money market funds returned 0.1% every year for the last 8 years. So people are saying, well, gee, you should have stayed with the stable value fund. The challenge is that you really can't have both, so you can't – there's limitations on having both. There's something called an equity wash provision. A stable value provider doesn't want you staying in the stable value fund until rates spike and then taking your money, moving it to a money market fund. So either you can't have both, or if you have both, you have to move your money to an equity fund for 90 or 180 days. So it really is a decision point, and that's the issue.
So one more on the wellness programs, which was, what kind of incentives are you seeing? Is it all premium reductions? And I do see premium reductions fairly consistently. But I've also seen some innovative employers offering larger items pursuant to a sweepstakes. Also have seen things like discount off of grocery stores and what you said, the gym membership.
I have a client who has a very elaborate system of a million different ways to earn points and then a million different ways to spend the points. And then we had to have a very complicated conversation about which of those ways to spend the points were taxable and non-taxable, and which could be rolled over to the next year, and whether points could be rolled over to the next year. But you can make it plenty complicated if you want.
But the complication brings fun.
It's fun for us.
I actually like for the employees, but we like it too.
But yeah, it's some of the complications bring engagement. Right, so in the sweepstakes, the client that has the sweepstakes, they break up into teams and they get this and that, and if you win, you get put into a drawing and you draw, you know,
for the iPad.
The iPad or the whatever presents. All right, so I think that we're finished. Thank you all for being here today. Thank you for those of you who are on the web. And we hope that we see you back here sometime soon. There's a little more snacks in the back of the room, so help yourself. And we're around if you want to call us and ask us questions after.
Thank you.
Thank you.